This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's not possible within the given resources and within the given operating environment in the country to reach out to all the people who need assistance.
That's Dr. Arif Noor, Save the Children's Country Director in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, hopes are diminishing for finding more survivors of Morocco's deadliest quake since 1960. And today, Nigeria experienced a nationwide power outage. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Analysts say years of conflict, political divisions, and neglect rendered Libya helpless as torrential rains from powerful storm Danielle burst two dams and swept entire neighborhoods into the Mediterranean Sea. For VOA's Dale Gavlak reports on the factors that have made Storm Danielle especially devastating for Libya.
Storm Danielle unleashed its devastation on eastern Libyan towns, uprooting roads and homes, while destroying two dams near the coastal city of Derna, where entire neighborhoods were swept into the Mediterranean. A Libyan official told the Associated Press that bodies are lying everywhere, in the sea, in the valleys, under the buildings. Stephanie Williams, a non-resident senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, served as a UN special advisor on Libya. Familiar with the stricken region, Williams told VOA it goes beyond a climate crisis-induced catastrophe, which has been compounded.
Conflict and division and administrative malfeasance, misgovernance, hitting this very vulnerable area. All of this converged to create a terribly catastrophic situation. Political instability, quite complicating in this environment, and I'm sure that there will be many who will want to play the blame game.
Saudi Arabia's Arab News newspaper said the startling death and devastation caused by the storm's intensity also exposed Libya's vulnerability after being divided between rival governments and torn apart by chaos for more than a decade. Libya, for the past 10 years, has gone from one war to another, one political crisis to another. Claudia Gazzini, a senior Libya analyst for the International Crisis Group, told the New York Times newspaper, "Essentially, this has meant that for the past 10 years, there hasn't really been much investment in the country's infrastructure," Gazzini said. Malak El-Tayeb, an analyst with Washington's Middle East Institute, told VOA that conflict and unrest have left social services severely weakened and a failure to maintain facilities like dams. Unfortunately, there were no mitigation strategies, early warning systems, or evacuation plans in place, he wrote in an emailed reply of the disaster in Derna, about 900 kilometers east of the capital, Tripoli, an area controlled by military commander Khalifa Haftar's forces. No measures were taken to protect civilians or reduce damage, El-Tayeb said. But Brookings analyst Williams said that despite the geopolitical divide, the rival internationally recognized government based in Tripoli in western Libya and allied with other armed groups is coming to the east's aid.
There's a great outreach from all Libyans to the people, particularly in Derna. The internationally recognized government in Tripoli has sent assistance, is allocating funds to help with the immediate humanitarian needs and long-term rebuilding.
Williams says desperately needed aid is also reaching people by civilian convoys from western Libya and by the national oil company to Libyans in the east. The division right now is not a barrier to assistance, she said. World Health Organization spokesperson Margaret Harris describes the flooding as being of epic proportions. Concerns have also arisen that migrants and refugees from more than 40 countries who use Libya as a launch point for Europe may have been caught up in the floods. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman.
As reported, Storm Danielle hit Libya's northeast coast with devastating effect. As the death toll began to mount, both the eastern-based Government of National Stability and the Government of National Unity in Tripoli promised support for devastated communities and rescue operations. The current count is more than 5,000 fatalities and thousands missing. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi whether the enormity of the tragedy could play a role in ending Libya's political stalemate and highlighting that most Libyans want a united country.
I think it has the potential to do that. I think it, certainly on the level of ordinary Libyan people, we've seen a real outpouring of solidarity and efforts to raise money, to send aid, to get rescuers in to the devastated areas in eastern Libya. And I think that has come across really strongly. We have seen moves by the GNU and the GNS and kind of rival authorities in across Libya, all also trying to help and to send aid. And we have seen that there are issues with the coordination because of the division, because of the lack of previous coordination, that actually it's making it much more difficult for rescuers to get to the areas that are needed. I think it's also making it more difficult for international organisations coming in because there's uncertainty about which authorities to deal with, who to liaise with, and that is making things more difficult. However, this kind of tragedy is showing that the authorities are able to attempt to work together and are trying to work together. The fear is, I think, that once these first few days of kind of the emergency response are over, that then there will be more of a blame game and that the status quo actors will attempt to use this more for their own kind of political games and messaging. So it may be a short-lived kind of act of unity, but the hope is that the kind of unity and solidarity shown by the Libyan people will almost force the politicians to continue on this kind of track of attempting to have greater unity within the country.
Is there a possibility of the tragedy resulting in aid rivalry as both sides seek to outperform the other in providing assistance and to demonstrate publicly their concern about the plight of those affected?
Yes, I think that's definitely the case. I think, you know, we're already seeing that in terms of the different governments and different agencies, you know, wanting to show the other that they are committing as much financial and kind of other resources. I think that's probably likely to continue, and I think we'll get more fraught as the days go on. We're already seeing that it's difficult for these different aid agencies and convoys to get into certain places, into Derna, for example. You know, a lot of the infrastructure has been destroyed, so I think we're going to see a narrative around that over, you know, who has been able to help and who hasn't. And I think very quickly it will start, you know, deteriorating into kind of a politicisation of that. I think there's also been quite a lot of anger among Libyans around the kind of international response to this as well. Although we're starting to see more media coverage of it now, it has been quite slow and limited coming in, and also the support from international actors. So I think the kind of attempts by different international actors to provide support may also be playing into this element of politicisation of the aid.
Anger over the state of Libya's preparedness for such a disaster and over its civil defenses is likely to soar in coming days with all the present political elite coming under attack. Could the disaster end up triggering a political storm for both the GNU and the GNS, especially if the death toll continues to grow and aid operations are slow to provide support?
Yes, I definitely think so. Already there's, you know, very important questions being asked about, you know, why the toll of this flooding has been so bad. The, you know, one of the key things that happened in Derna was the two of the dams burst, and it seems that there are reports indicating that actually it had been flagged previously that, you know, there was a danger if there was some significant amounts of rainfall that this could burst and, you know, could have devastating effects, which is what has happened. So I think there will be a lot of questions around how the eastern authorities managed, you know, the infrastructure and elements in there. Also, Derna itself, which is one of the worst affected cities, has a long history of being marginalised. It was a key kind of centre of Islamists a few years ago, and since then has been kind of ostracised and marginalised by the eastern authorities. So I think that will play into a lot of the anger. On the other side, you know, a long-standing eastern grievance is that the eastern region has not received as much in the way of resources and funding and attention from Tripoli. So I think that will also play into it. And I think overarching all of this, whether East or West, the kind of long-standing grievance among normal Libyans about the corruption and the kind of abuse of political position that we see throughout the Libyan kind of elite. So I think certainly that those questions are going to become more and more prominent. I think the anger is going to grow. The question will be how these political elites respond to it and what happens next. I think in the short term, it's going to be focused on the disaster management. But in the days and weeks after, I think this could be a real watershed moment for Libya in terms of what happens next.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Hopes are dimming for finding more survivors of Morocco's deadliest quake since 1960. Some wonder why the country has not accepted more humanitarian aid and technical assistance. Brahim El Gouabli, chair and association professor of Arabic studies at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam there's actually maybe some legitimate reasons for the decision. VOA has reached out to the Moroccan embassy in Washington for comment, but has yet to receive a response.
Some aid has been accepted, some has not. And there was, for example, a statement from the Algerian Foreign Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying that they officially got an answer from Morocco that their help was not needed at this point. And I think talking to some other Moroccan colleagues who have information, they say that the country might have enough resources to cover some aspects of the rescue efforts. But at the same time, I don't know if that's the right response, like when you can benefit from the expertise of places that have had been or had been hit hard in the past.
The British ambassador to Morocco said some 60 UK search and rescue experts and four search dogs arrived in the country sometime this week, I guess, to support the Moroccan-led operations. But as you know, the US, for one, has offered. I know France has offered. Other countries have offered. And they still, to our knowledge, have not received any response. With some quake so overwhelming like this, doesn't it seem unusual that a country would not accept all of the aid that they can get?
That's not something that's really explained. Like you would go, for example, to the website of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation and say, well, there is a statement that explains the logic behind it. What you can see, like some Moroccan analysts who discuss what the government is doing or the decisions that's making. And what they've seen so far is that, for example, states that have diplomatic issues with Morocco in the last few years or even in the past decades are not allowed to bring in aid. But I think the baseline for me is when people need help, it's really important to accept the help that you have. And also sometimes crises are a moment of openness and reconciliation, and they can create a clean slate for states to talk to each other and probably resolve issues that were not that they were not able to resolve, for example, in normal times. So like overtures to kind of like mend what can be mended, and a sign of goodwill to move forward. Aid is really important to accept, particularly I think expertise like in rescue and with gadgets and ultrasound.
It does involve people bringing in devices and things like that that you were talking about, electronic devices. And could that be possibly a reason why there's some perceived reluctance to allow a broad number of aid groups and from different countries because they're afraid of more scrutiny, perhaps?
One of the explanations that they've seen and heard is one that says it would be too overwhelming for the area to receive so many people in addition to all the Moroccans who are mobilized and all the people who are there to have additional crews and people who are coming into the area. Because as you know, it's isolated, it's remote, the roads are not in a good shape and in an area that's already like highly impenetrable. But at the same time, you can also be selective in accepting some teams that have some expertise that would actually help rescue people.
That's Brahim El Gobli, chair and association a professor of Arabic studies at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nigeria experienced a nationwide power outage today after a fire at a power plant collapsed the electrical grid. The grid had shut down several times in recent years in a country that is a major oil exporter and one of the Africa's wealthiest nations. Many people in the country are frustrated with the situation. Gracie Adams is a public servant, and she shared her frustration with a reporter in Abuja.
I'm actually not happy about it. I don't know what to say. I'm speechless. This is collapsing everything. If the national grid collapses, everything collapses. You know. So, I mean, people are struggling to survive. They use electricity for businesses and all of that. And this is just not good. It's not good at all.
Ben Dudu says the grid problems add to the economic and other struggles of Nigerians.
It is really sad to hear this news again that the grid has collapsed. Like, how many times is the grid going to collapse in 1 year? This should be like the third or the fourth time. It is really painful. See, Nigerians are going through a lot. First, it was fuel subsidy, and that has not been resolved. We have not seen the palliatives and all that, and now we are hearing the national grid. Can the government just do something for Nigerians to breathe? We are going through a lot, President Tinubu. We are calling on you, please. Let Nigerians breathe. We know this is beyond you, but do something about it.
Public servant Jane Eki says someone should be held accountable for the repeated outages.
At times like this, I actually wonder what privatization means. Who should be held responsible for the national grid collapsing? Something needs to be done. We can't continue having blackouts as a result of national grid collapsing when Nigeria supplies electricity to other countries. No, it's not right.
Steve Isabu is a journalist, and he wants to know why there never has been a full explanation for the repeated grid outages.
Every time national grid has collapsed, what is going on? Why is our national grid always collapsing? Why are people who are supposed to do something about it, what are they doing about it? It can't be happening once, twice, three times. Somebody should give us an answer. Why this grid collapse is not being addressed once and for all.
The power went out nationwide shortly after midnight. By early afternoon, national and international media reported it was gradually coming back on. Because of frequent local and national outages, many Nigerian homes and businesses have backup generators. However, after the government eliminated subsidies for fuel a few months ago, the cost of running them has risen sharply. Sudan has now the dubious distinction of having the most displaced children on earth. Millions of families fleeing the conflict between the Sudan army and the paramilitary group are sheltering wherever they can, including camps and schools. With huge funding shortfalls, aid groups are being forced to make tough choices. Dr. Arif Noor, Save the Children's Country Director in Sudan, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, millions of Sudanese kids need help now.
We have now seen almost 5 months of active conflict. We don't see an end in sight. It seems that it will continue for quite some time. It's very difficult to predict when this will end. So apart from the destruction that this conflict has caused for the people who are in the areas which are seeing active conflicts, such as Khartoum, the Darfur region, and the Kordofan region, we are seeing rising levels of hunger across the country, which is likely to affect a vast majority of the country. According to the latest projections, almost 47% of the whole population of the country, which is more than 20 million people, they're experiencing level of crisis. They are seeing acute food insecurity. This is according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, which is called as the IPC. The level of hunger that will be, or the food insecurity will be at levels 3 and 4.
And that classification, of course, is a very scientific, you know, very detailed classification. And they don't use the word famine lightly or acute hunger. We just heard from the World Food Program a day or two ago that their levels of funding have been basically cut in half. And yet we have all these tragedies happening. How are you dealing with the shortfall in funding? And how do you decide, you know, who to feed and who you just simply cannot feed?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the humanitarian response plan was revised after the war broke out, and it remains woefully underfunded. So it's only 27% funded. So what we are trying to do is to reach out to as many people as possible within our given resources. However, that means that several people are unable to benefit from the humanitarian assistance that's being provided. And unfortunately, children are the ones who suffer the most. So there are difficulties around accessing the people who need the assistance most. But at the same time, it's wherever the assistance is available, sometimes it's difficult for the people to access that assistance that's available. And it's not possible within the given resources and within the given operating environment in the country to reach out to all the people who need assistance.
How do you do that, though? I mean, do you cut the rations and try to feed more people? Or how does it actually carry out on the ground when you have this cut in funding?
Yeah. So what we do is, in Save the Children's case, we have an integrated response where we provide health nutrition services along with improved water sanitation and hygiene services. So the people who reach out to us, we try to provide them the best services that we can within the given resources. For example, the ready-to-use supplementary feeding is becoming hugely difficult. So what we are trying to do is to draw on whatever reserves we had with us before the war broke out. We are trying to use those, but those reserves are not going to last forever.
That's Dr. Arif Noor, Save the Children's Country Director in Sudan. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam today from Port Sudan. Rwanda's Atomic Energy Board says it has signed a deal with a Canadian-German company to build its first small-scale nuclear reactor to test what the company claims is a new approach for nuclear fission. Rwanda is exploring nuclear power to help meet its growing energy needs. But according to the Associated Press, officials say this reactor won't produce any electricity for the country's grid. Instead, it will explore the technology developed by Dual Fluid Energy Inc. to address the need for low carbon energy. Officials told the Associated Press that if all goes well, they could set up a production line of such reactors in the Central African nation, which is one of the world's most densely populated. Observers say the project design is early in development. Only South Africa has an operational nuclear power plant on the continent. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.